It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. 50 years after the Tet Offensive and the turning point of the Vietnam War, Pittsburgh area veterans returned to the site for reflections, closure. With funding not increasing from the state, what's the impact on Pitt and other state-related universities? That's coming up. But first, the Parkland school shootings 2 weeks ago that left 17 dead have catalyzed a series of actions. Allies called for a boycott against the NRA, with a few airlines and rental car companies rescinding their member discounts. On Wednesday, Pittsburgh-based Dick's pulled the plug on so-called assault-style rifle sales and upped the buying age for firearms. Also this week, Republican President Donald Trump sat down with lawmakers, calling on them to act. We're going to talk about the political, legal, recreational, and business implications of these actions with reporter Ben Schmidt from the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Hello, Ben.
Hey, hello. Great to be here again.
Also in studio, John Haynes, outdoors editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Welcome, John.
Good morning.
And on the line from Washington, reporter Laura Olson, who covers the Capitol for the Allentown Morning Call. Thanks for joining us, Laura.
Thanks for having me.
And later in the conversation, 90.5 WESA's legal analyst David Harris will also weigh in. Your comments and questions are always welcome. Tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. All right, it seems like politicians and businesses have heard the outcry from surviving students and the parents of students killed in the Parkland shootings. Laura, I mean, I know there was a testimony and comments in Washington. Let's start with you. Are they reacting to that so-called outcry?
Yeah, we've seen some commotion on Capitol Hill as there's been another resurgence of kind of the same pattern that we've seen after many of these mass shootings. Lawmakers face questions about what they're going to do. There's some activity and new proposals. Folks who put forward some old proposals again, including Republican Senator Pat Toomey from Pennsylvania, who again is putting forward the background check bill that he had first introduced with Democratic Senator Joe Manchin of West Virginia after that Sandy Hook shooting way back in 2013. So while there's a lot of activity, it's still very unclear whether any of that's going to lead to legislation that could make it to the president's desk. While we saw a pretty unusual meeting at the White House that was televised live with some of those lawmakers, where there was quite a bit of discussion about some of the ideas, it's still very unclear how many of them will make it through Capitol Hill and back to his desk.
Right. I want to get to that meeting and the possibility of legislation. But, Ben, you wanted to add a comment.
Well, yeah, I think the refrain is, will there be any changes? And there's a lot of discussion right now, a lot of emotion on both sides. But in the end, is anything going to happen? We don't know yet.
Okay. Well, Wednesday, Dick's chairman and CEO, Edward Stack, issued a statement saying the company respects and supports the Second Amendment, but they have a responsibility to help solve the problem of gun violence. WESA spoke with some customers outside the Dick's store at the waterfront in Homestead.
I mean, there's so little that we can do, it seems, and it seems if we vote with our pocketbook, I think that's something we can do, and that's what I'm going to do, and I hope other people do too.
It's going to be interesting to see how it affects Dick's business. Personally, I think they did the right things. Assault rifles don't need to be in the hands of minors.
I also have AK-47, and I like AR-15s, but I'd give any one of them up if I could take one of them kids and save their life.
John Hayes, outdoor editor of the Post-Gazette. What have you heard since that announcement from people? What voices you've sought out to get reaction?
I've got a story that's going to run on Sunday in the Post-Gazette. I talked with representatives of some hunting groups about how they feel about what's going on. They're concerned about the knee-jerk aspect of talking about legislation immediately after things happen like this. For instance, we're talking about getting rid of assault-style weapons. I brought a visual aid, which will work really well on radio.
Okay.
So kind of describe what you see there in general terms.
Well, I see a rifle with a stock with an ammo clip. That's really about what I see.
Looks kind of like a machine gun, huh?
It looks that way, yes.
Yeah, and this one here?
It looks like a standard rifle with a scope.
Yeah, well, Both of them have what's called a detachable box magazine. Both of those will hold the same amount of ammunition. So if you're talking about banning a class of guns, this class of gun that looks just like a sporting arm, in fact, it is a sporting arm, can hold the same amount of ammunition as the other. So I think that hunters want the jargon to be right. They want people to know exactly what they're talking about. If you're talking about removing clips or high capacity magazines, that may be different than guns.
Well, that brings us, Ben and Laura, to a story that Ben did prior to the sit-down meeting at the White House and prior to Dick's announcement. You did a story about, really, what is the AR-15? What is this this rifle that we hear so much about that is controversial, maybe because of misunderstanding or just not a lack of or due to a lack of information? So what did you find out?
Yeah, and absolutely. I went out myself to learn what an AR-15 is because you just saw the visuals here, and I know the listeners can't, but it does look ominous. But I learned right away. That's one of the first. I went to a gun shop in Westmoreland County, and that's one of the first things that the owner did is he pulled out a BAR rifle that looks like a hunting rifle, and then he pulled out an AR-15, and he said, "These hold the same. They hold the same style magazine, same capacity." Then he also showed me that the BAR actually fires a larger caliber bullet. So it's pretty interesting. I also learned that AR stands for the company Armalite that originally made this rifle, not assault rifle that a lot of people think.
Yeah. Okay. And John, I understand that I'm told that the AR-15 is also used in shooting competitions. Is that as well?
Well, AR derivatives. People call them AR-15s and they call them assault rifles. Those are generic words that aren't really accurate.
Okay.
They're AR derivatives. And there's all kinds of them. It's that machine gun looking kind of gun that you're talking about.
Okay.
And they do use them for sporting events. Last year in Pennsylvania, they became legal for hunting small game in Pennsylvania. By the way, Pennsylvania was the last state in the union to not allow semi-automatic rifles for hunting.
All right. Now, are many hunters using that though?
No. No. Okay.
So why was it passed?
Well, it's past Pennsylvania is the last state that didn't allow semi-automatic rifles. Semi-automatic shotguns are allowed in Pennsylvania for waterfowl shooting. You have to plug it to 3 rounds. But, Pennsylvanians, I guess the Game Commission felt, why do we have some monopoly on wisdom here, you know?
Laura Olson in Washington, is there a lot of discussion over this particular rifle, or is it the broader concepts of what some lawmakers want to address?
So I think the debate down here has really kind of spiraled out from what started on a focus on background checks and kind of resuming what had been a debate over fixing some of the ways that records are reporting. And this comes back to one of the last shootings that we saw. This wasn't a new idea after the Florida shooting in terms of making sure that states and federal agencies are passing along the correct records so that when a background check occurs, that the proper records are in the database so that you have the information to determine whether someone should pass that background check. And amid that discussion, we've seen a range of other ideas come forward, including some who want to ban assault rifles outright. There isn't as much discussion, perhaps, as there should be about what exactly that means. Some who want to focus more on what to do about schools and how to protect schools, perhaps arming teachers. We've seen really a pretty broad range of where the discussion could go, and that is always one of the challenges, is that once it goes from being a narrower discussion about background checks, perhaps, to a much broader discussion about various ways to change which guns are available, who can access them, and other parts of that system, then we tend to see the wheels come off the wagon. We can't find support for any of the proposals, even the narrow one that we may have started with, and then something else happens and Congress moves on to the next issue. So it would probably be helpful if there was more discussion down here about some of the nuances of it, but usually the debate seems to change to the next pressing issue, and we never kind of get further into some of those definitions.
Ben Schmidt, I know you were outside some Dick stores after Dick's announcement. Very briefly, what are the key points that Dick's has adopted?
The key points are that the Field & Stream subsidiary stores are going to adopt the policy that Dick's already had, that they are not going to sell, they took AR-15s down off their shelves and similar style weapons. The other thing is they are no longer selling long guns and rifles to or any firearms to anybody under 21. And I believe they're doing something else with magazines.
No large clips, I believe.
Yeah.
Yeah. So, so what are you? Is there one that you're hearing about, John, that is sort of sticking maybe in the craw of outdoor enthusiasts?
Well, nobody's in favor of people getting shot in schools. Hunters, I'm finding, are very curious about this 21 and over trend. I talked to a guy yesterday who represents a large hunting group in Pennsylvania. He mentions Dylan Roof, the guy who shot the people in Charleston, South Carolina, 21. The Amish school shooter was 32. The Pulse nightclub guy was 29. Stephen Paddock right. in Las Vegas was 34. Mm. There doesn't seem to be a more people using these for crimes who are underage.
Laura, I want to start with you and get some thoughts. So there's this... John was mentioning 21, that sort of cutoff point, if you would. Yet the U.S. government, through its military, puts weapons in the hands of 18-year-olds. Are you anything in Washington that you're hearing about that sort of, is it a contradiction or not?
Yeah, and I think the other comparison we've heard is the age to purchase a handgun being 21 and the discrepancy between the two of those. And among Pennsylvania lawmakers, we've seen kind of a range of responses. There are a couple in the eastern half of the state, Republicans Brian Fitzpatrick and Republican Charlie Dent, who had signed on to a bill to raise the age to 21 for those who would want to purchase a weapon or purchase a rifle. And others who have been more skeptical. We heard from Republican Senator Pat Toomey throughout the week saying that, using that exact word, saying he was skeptical of whether that's something we should pursue because, in his words, there are plenty of 18, 19, 20-year-old in Pennsylvania and elsewhere who are law-abiding citizens, and he's not so sure about taking away their right to purchase a rifle.
Well, speaking of Pat Toomey, the senator was one of the bipartisan group of lawmakers who sat down with President Trump Wednesday afternoon to talk about what could be done legislatively. And the president indicated he might be willing to break with the gun lobby.
I can say that the NRA is opposed to it. And I'm a fan of the NRA. I mean, there's no bigger fan. I'm a big fan of the NRA. They want to do it. These are great people. These are great patriots. They love our country. But that doesn't mean we have to agree on everything.
All right. And not, keep getting mixed signals, Ben Schmidt.
Well, and I think back to the issue with Dick's and then also Walmart now. In Pennsylvania, at least, you can still go, if you're under 21, still go to a smaller gun shop and make purchases of rifles and long guns. And so some smaller shops might actually benefit from this.
Okay. I'm going to get to some comments from WESA's legal analyst, taking a look at the whole legal issue behind all this. We're talking about legislatively. We're talking about the impact on recreation, et cetera. Megan Harris, a Confluence reporter, spoke with our legal analyst, David Harris, about how some of the laws came to be.
David, our current understanding of the Second Amendment comes from a Supreme Court decision 10 years ago. It found citizens should be able to own any firearm, quote, in common use at the time, and not dangerous or unusual. Take us back to our revolutionary roots here. What were the justices talking about?
For decades and decades, the meaning of the Second Amendment, as understood by the Supreme Court, had been this is only about a militia-type group, like the National Guard, like National Defense. In that 2008 case, Heller versus the District of Columbia, Heller changed all that, and Scalia got his ammunition, if you like, by going all the way back to the Revolutionary period and asking what kind of weapons would have been in use in a militia. Everybody served in the militia. The citizens would be called out. So the weapons in common use at that time and nothing unusual or dangerous are all permitted under the Second Amendment for purposes like self-defense. That was Justice Scalia's interpretation using the Revolutionary Era history.
But a lot of the mass incidents we're seeing in the news right now, Newtown, Orlando, Las Vegas, now Parkland, were all committed with high-powered weapons like the AR-15.
Yes.
Late Justice Antonin Scalia that you talked about, he wrote that Supreme Court decision, but did he mean to imply that an AR should be in common use?
No, I don't think he necessarily said that. He just says the Second Amendment is not without limits. You can regulate weapons.
Right. Felons aren't supposed to buy guns. You can't have them near schools or government buildings.
Certainly. But whether an AR-15 qualifies as unusual or dangerous, he kind of leaves open. Guns are allowed for self-defense, and we'll look at weapons type by type if a state decides to regulate them, if the federal government decides to regulate them, to ask whether they are dangerous or unusual.
There's debate nationally about restricting access for those who struggle with mental health. Here in Pennsylvania, a federal judge ruled in December that a history of involuntary commitment wasn't enough to bar someone from owning a gun.
Absolutely. And Justice Scalia mentioned mental illness in the Heller opinion. He said there is no problem with having laws that restrict gun access for people with histories of mental illness. And what this judge said was that to be evaluated so sort of overnight or in a short period for a mental health issue is not the same, does not qualify a person as having been a, quote, mental defective under the federal law, and therefore you cannot be permanently barred from having weapons. It's still the case that states or the federal government can make laws that keep weapons from people with a history of mental illness. That's not in question at all.
David Harris is 90.5 WESA's legal analyst, a law professor at the University of Pittsburgh, and the host of the Criminal Injustice Podcast. Thanks, David.
My pleasure.
Laura Olson, I want to get back to you now. What are you hearing in Washington? Is there an appetite for change and even enough votes to make anything happen?
So after Wednesday's meeting, when the president seemed to keep pointing back to Senator Toomey's background check bill as a building block for some sort of more comprehensive legislation, Senator Toomey has seemed to kind of run with that. He's been he met again with Joe Manchin. He got a call from the president to talk about this a little bit further, and they're trying to see if they can push it forward. But right now, there's no timetable for any sort of a vote in the Senate, and there was a kind of lukewarm at best response from the majority leader when he was asked on Thursday, as the Senate was departing for the week, about when this might come back up next week. They're moving on to a banking bill.
Moving on to banking. All right, John Hayes, I wanted to ask you, there are all kinds of points of contention, discussion, everything from all gun sales subject to background checks, that's run up, restrictions related to mental health, as we heard from David Harris, more coordinated databases. What are you hearing from talking to people regarding what might be, you know, acceptable, pass something that can be accepted by a majority?
As a part of the story I was talking about that's going to run Sunday, I was asking people, where do you think a fair compromise would be? And I had trouble getting that from anybody. The one guy said, it's a slippery slope. He said, the pro-hunting guys, he says, his quote is, they hear the anti-lobby or anti-gun lobby saying this is a good first step. Well, that suggests there are more steps, and they're wondering where that will end.
Okay. Ben Schmidt.
Yeah, similar. I heard similar things. When I went to a few gun shops, one thing I will say is that the owners I spoke with, they do feel as if something is going to change. They just don't know exactly what, but they do feel that this might be the time that something is going to change.
Very briefly, Laura, are you hearing any concern that you try to pass maybe sort of an omnibus bill that tries to include too much, and that doesn't go anywhere because you can't get agreement on it, as opposed to taking a step-by-step approach?
Yeah, Senator Toomey was saying that he hoped to at least get either his bill or some bill onto the floor, and then they could debate amendments. And if there was support for those, they'd make it into the bill, and if not, at least something else could venture forward. But it seems like the bigger question down here right now is whether President Trump can help bringing anyone who may be reluctant to the table. And we're starting to see from his press secretary this morning some steps, perhaps backtracking a little bit away from some of the things we heard from him on Wednesday, which would not really be helpful in building momentum towards any sort of bill.
All right, we have just 1 minute left. I want to get each of your takes on this. What are you going to be keeping your eye on as this issue progresses? About 20 seconds for you, John Hayes.
One of the few bright spots that I see is the Toomey Manchin collaboration. Those guys from different parties seem to be working sort of together, and maybe something will come out of that.
All right, Ben Schmidt, about 20 seconds.
I'm very curious to keep following the corporate response, not only with the instances like Dick's and Walmart's, but also just some of the backlash against the NRA from certain companies.
Well, Laura Olson, they were so tight on that time, they gave you 30 seconds.
And I'll be watching, as I was just saying, what the president does. If he sticks to it, if he sticks to some of his positions and gives kind of a clear path of what he's looking for, that could be helpful in getting lawmakers to line up on Capitol Hill. And if he moves on to other things, it's likely that Capitol Hill will move on to other things.
All right. Laura Olson is a reporter covering the Capitol for the Allentown Morning Call. Ben Schmitz, a reporter for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. And John Hayes is the outdoors editor for the Pittsburgh Post-Gazette. Thanks to all of you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, Governor Wolf has proposed flat funding for Pitt and three others. The state of the state-related universities next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
Here's what's trending in Pittsburgh. I'm Sarah Kovash. Gun enthusiasts sporting metallic crowns gathered at a Pennsylvania church this week for a commitment ceremony featuring AR-15 rifles. Members of World Peace and Unification Sanctuary believe the automatic weapon represents the rod of iron from the Book of Revelation. And the family of a teen who works at a local Chick-fil-A is suing Steeler safety Sean Davis, who featured the boy in a Snapchat video. The family says the teen was bullied as a result. Find more at WESA.FM.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin.
I'm proposing an increase for the state system, increases for community colleges. The four state-related basically stay the same. I'm trying to do what I can with the resources we have here to keep things the same or keep moving forward, not do what was done in the past, and that is cut.
All right, that's Governor Tom Wolf talking to me about funding for higher education in his budget proposal for the new fiscal year. We're going to talk about the state of state-related universities with Deb Eardley. She joins us on the line. She reports on education for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Hello, Deb.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me on.
And in studio is Bill Schachner, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter. He covers higher education. Good to have you back on the program, Bill.
Thank you. Good to have you.
And if you have questions or comments, please tweet us and use the hashtag WESAConfluence. I want to get to the funding for the state-related universities and how they've been seeing really no increases after some cuts earlier. But first, Deb, I want to start with you and then have Bill chime in. Remind us, what are the primary differences between state-related universities, including Pitt, and the 14 state-owned universities?
Well, the state-related universities are research universities. They have a full research component, which most of the state colleges, state universities, state-owned universities do not. They also are not covered by some of the laws that the state-owned universities are. For instance, they're not subject to RTK and as much
right to know
transparency as the state-owned universities. There's also the issue of enrollment, where they draw their students from, and the bar to get into the schools is a little bit different.
Right. That's and the funding discussion here is unusual, in part just because Pennsylvania's public university structure is unusual. In most states, you have either universities that are state universities or private universities, but these four state-related universities, Pitt, Penn State, Temple, and Lincoln, they're neither private nor fully state-owned. And even when finances were stronger in the Commonwealth, there was this debate about how much should these institutions get relative to the state universities, which are fully state-owned and are state agencies.
Now, Bill, you said unusual. How rare? I mean, is this the only state?
Just
like
about
that?
Unique. Just about unique.
Oh. Most states have a system of higher education that covers everything from their state-owned research universities, their comprehensive state-owns, down to their community colleges. Pennsylvania is sort of this fragmented creature.
Mm-hmm. And each of these institutions came to be state-related for different reasons. In the case of Pitt, Pitt was in a real financial bind in the 1960s, and the infusion of state funding that came along with becoming a state-related helped the university weather that and then continued to grow. And in return, the state was able to gain a stake in a large research complex without all the expense that they would have otherwise incurred to create that sort of a university.
So they didn't all become state-related universities? It wasn't like a one fell swoop, four become state-related?
No, different each institution for different reasons.
Yeah.
Bill just mentioned different reasons. Deb, do you know what other reasons there were? Of course, we're talking about Penn State. That's the biggie of the four, but also Lincoln and Temple. Any other particular reasons?
I really don't know the history of the others, other than Penn State was originally what the Farmers High School, and it became a college under the Morrill Land Grant.
The typical state university we hear about, the Michigan State, et cetera.
In just about any other state, these universities would represent the elite research tier of the state university system. I mean, you look at Ohio State, that is a state university. That is a research university.
Right.
It's a different structure in Pennsylvania.
All right. I want to get to the finances, the tuition, the funding, all the fun numbers. According to reports based on the 2015-16 tuition, University of Pittsburgh had the highest in-state tuition of any public university in the country. Penn State was third. I believe Temple was ninth. For this year, Pennsylvania as a whole ranks as the third highest state in terms of public university tuition. Do we know why?
It has to do with the level of subsidies they receive from the state. If you look at other states, the legislatures are subsidizing their universities to a higher level than Pennsylvania is.
Yeah, consistently, Pennsylvania ranks near the bottom among the 50 states in support for higher education, something like 47th or 48th among the states, depending on if you're looking per capita or per $1,000 of family income.
So Pitt gets approximately how much a year?
Well, at one point it was substantially more than this, but right now they are receiving about $144.2 million in direct subsidy.
And, of course, Deb, Penn State gets more than that, being the larger university.
A little bit more than that, yes. And they like to say in both instances that they use that money to subsidize tuition for in-state students. The in-state tuition rate at Penn State this year is about $11,000 less than it is for an out-of-state student.
So, Bill, I'm going to start with you and have Deb chime in. So am I hearing this right that if the appropriations were higher, we're just talking about state taxpayers paying more tax dollars to keep the tuition down, as opposed to tuition being higher and the parents and the students paying more?
You're absolutely right. I mean, this is a tentacle of a much broader discussion nationally about who really should pay for the cost of a public higher education. Will it be taxpayers in the form of direct subsidies to campuses, or will it be families through higher tuitions?
Bill, you recently reported on what if Pitt were to go private? I mean, we're talking about, you just mentioned about $140 million. So what were you hearing that led you to this story, this report?
Well, it's the whole issue of support for these universities goes back to an argument about, are these institutions privileged, fiscally bloated institutions that simply should control their costs more, or is it a situation where the state wants to enjoy all the benefits that accrue of having research universities like these institutions but does not want to pay for them? It used to be a lot different about 10, 15 years ago. Every year, the governor and the legislature would settle on a budget, and the institutions would make no secret of how unhappy they were about the size of the appropriation. it's changed. The response has been much more muted. You're not hearing as vocal a response on the funding level.
Mm-hmm. Bill's right about that. It is they're very hesitant to speak out, but this notion of going private, this has been something that they've whispered about in their own circles for years. What if we left them?
Mm-hmm. Just Pitt,
we could leave them. We could exist on our own. What would happen then?
I'm sorry, Deb. Just Pitt or other state related?
Pitt more so than anyone else. I really can't tell you what the situation is at the other state-related, but in Pittsburgh, I've heard this whisper for years, and Bill probably has too. It's just sort of and what if we left them? We could break out. We have Pitt has really become a national university. It's gone from, you know, a streetcar university to a university that gets all kinds of applications from students across this country, yet they keep their enrollment at the undergraduate level in Oakland, it's about 2.5 to 1 in-state students. University-wide, it's a little more like 2 to 1, but those Pennsylvania students are getting that break, and every now and then Pitt looks at their applications and says, we're turning away a lot of bright out-of-state kids. We could be charging a whole lot more and getting away with it. That's the kind of private conversation that's going on. They look up the hill at Carnegie Mellon, a private university where the full ticket for a year is probably approaching $70,000.
Yeah, Deb's right.
And with room and board and tuition. So they look at that and they say, well, we could do that.
And
we wouldn't
Pitt's
have to take
not,
all these Pennsylvania kids.
Yeah, and actually, Pitt is not the Pitt's not the first institution among the four that has contemplated this. In 2011, Penn State had a bit of a flirtation with the idea of becoming private. I think they were looking at Cornell University as a potential model. The board chairman at the time mentioned that, and the university quickly walked that back. I think where a lot of this, the whispering, the discussion comes from, has been the evolution of the funding relative to these institutions' budgets. Take Pitt, for example. The share of Pitt's budget covered by the Commonwealth now is at one point was something like 20-30%. Now it's down to like 7%. So the question becomes, if you're a public university, but almost 95% of your funding comes from other sources, how public are you really? And I think that's kind of where a lot of this discussion is rooted.
In our remaining 2 minutes, I wanted to ask you each, what if, what would be the impact on the universities? What would be the impact on the students and their parents as far as if Pitt did go private? We'll start with you, Deb.
Well, I think you'd see that tuition go up. I think you'd see that $30,000 a year for out-of-state students. You'd see that across the board, and you would probably see a lot more out-of-state or international students enrolled as well. This notion that we have a responsibility to educate Pennsylvanians, that responsibility wouldn't be as incumbent upon the schools.
Bill?
Yeah, that's true. And I think actually both sides would lose something in this. I think certainly the institutions would lose a significant part of their identity. I mean when you strip aside a lot of the things about the university, they are still rooted in that streetcar public university tradition. And the state would lose basically its most elite tier within the public university system, and they would lose control over those institutions.
Bill, one final thing to you, and it had to do with your report about if Pitt would go private. What's the chancellor doing sort of dangling the Amazon question out there?
Well, it's, you know, and he's not the only one that has raised that in general. I mean, what he's suggesting is that when they talk about these institutions, sometimes legislators talk about them as financial burdens, but in reality, what the chancellor's saying is that keep in mind that if you really want to have a bright workforce that attracts corporations, that these institutions are attracting the best and brightest students, and if the university has to raise its tuition even higher because it doesn't have a subsidy, it's going to lose a lot of those students to other states, and the Pennsylvania workforce suffers.
And Deb Eardley, very quickly, 10-15 seconds. Is this just whispers, or is there serious discussions, you think, about Pitt? 10 seconds.
I think it's still whispers, but that's just an opinion. I can't tell you for sure. I think it's just out there, along with Pitt having emphasized again and again how much they contribute to the economy, how they were part of the Eds and Meds renaissance in Pittsburgh.
Deb Ergerle reports on education for the Pittsburgh Tribune Review. Bill Schachner, Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter, he covers higher education. Thanks so much to both of you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Kevin.
Coming up, 50 years ago, the Tet Offensive proved to be the turning point of the Vietnam War. Pittsburgh area veterans recently returned to Vietnam. We'll discuss their stories next on The Confluence on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, legendary Pittsburgh Steelers sportscaster Myron Cope dies at the age of 79. Cope is best known for his unique catchphrases and for helping invent the terrible towel.
I went on the air and said, bring a yellow, gold, or black towel to the game, will you? If you don't have one, buy one. You don't want to buy one, dye one.
He was the first pro football announcer inducted into the Radio Hall of Fame and has an asteroid named after him. That's this week's Pittsburgh Almanac for March 2nd, 2018.
It's The Confluence, where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. This year marks the 50th anniversary of the Tet Offensive, one of the largest military campaigns carried out during the Vietnam War. North Vietnamese and the Viet Cong forces carried out a series of surprise attacks against the South Vietnamese and U.S. military forces. Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Diana Nelson-Jones and photographer Nate Guidry accompanied a group of Vietnam War veterans who traveled to the coastal nation last month. Diana and Nate's work resulted in a series of stories and images on the Post-Gazette website, Dispatches from Vietnam. Diana and Nate, thanks so much for joining us today.
Thank you.
Thank you very much for having us.
Okay, Tet refers to the Tet holiday, the Vietnamese New Year, January 30th, 1968, but that was just really the start of the offensive, which officially lasted through September, although I believe they talked mostly about the first 2 months of the offensive. So tell us about the men and women that traveled with you, that you traveled with. What did you know about them before your trip? Let's start with you, Diana.
I only knew about George Haught, who is from Monaca. He's the reason we went. And Colonel Meadows, Chuck Meadows, who I had interviewed on the phone before we went. The others were just people that we met when we got there.
Okay. Nate?
George Haught was the only person I knew. I met him middle of last year doing a veterans breakfast in Beaver County. The Veterans Breakfast Club had hosted a group of middle school students at an area school, and that's where I met George.
Okay. Diana and Nate, did you, as storytellers, as journalists, or the former service personnel that you chronicled, do you know, did you have goals? Did they have goals for this trip?
Well, my goal was to honor these people who were asked to do so much and to sacrifice so much. And specifically George, whose story I had heard before we went, I wanted to witness his return. Mm-hmm. I wanted to witness his emotional return, whatever that might have done for him. I wanted to be there to see it and to write about it because I thought it was important.
For both of us, it was George. I mean, he had mentioned to me during my visit with him last year that he wanted to return so that he could say goodbye to all of the people that all of his friends that were killed in the war. So I knew that I wanted to be there when he went.
What were the broader reflections of the veterans that you visited with regarding the significance of Tet, regarding the overall outcome of the war? Did you get into that?
Not so much. Many of the guys we went with have been back already.
Right.
I think maybe it's a way for them to maintain camaraderie with each other, as well as, you know, each step back, each return, each footstep you take back may be another ounce of relief that you get in your life. We didn't really ask them to reflect too much on the war itself. It was a stinking mess of a war, and I think they don't want to go there.
So you mentioned George Haught from Monaca. This was his first trip back?
Yes, it was.
So could you put that into comparison to some of the other service personnel, former Marines that you focused a lot of your reporting on, because Chuck Meadows, I believe it is, he was the commander of the company that George was a part of. And Chuck, you mentioned your stories have been back dozens of times. And then another person you focus on, Danny Chalawa, I believe it is. He had been back once before. What was the different perspectives of somebody who's been there a lot of times since, somebody going back for the first time, and somebody who was there, say, 20 years ago?
Chuck had told me that because he was a career Marine, he had a chance to talk about this all through his career with other Marines. So he had sort of disassembled and assimilated the grief and tragedy that he saw into his life. For somebody like Danny, who'd been back just one time, he was at least sort of something for George to hang on to. Danny kind of knew the ropes from having been back once. And George, of course, his emotion was quite raw.
Hang on to is a very interesting phrase that you used, Diana, because that brings me to a photo that I saw of yours, Nate, where Danny and George, they're consoling each other as they crossed the perfume bridge to Way City, where their big battle was, I guess.
Yeah, well, I mean, I followed them as they crossed the bridge. We all crossed the bridge together. And as we got closer to the end, I could see George getting more and more emotional. And as we crossed the bridge, he began to tear up. And as he described it, he lost it. And at that point, instinctively, I guess, Danny knew exactly what to do. He embraced him. And I was right there to take the image. And it was really the image that I knew I had gone there to take. Mm-hmm. Because like I mentioned earlier, George said he was going back so that he could properly say goodbye to all of his friends. And as
who
he
didn't return.
That's right, who was killed during the first few days of the battle. So he began to tear up, and Danny was there to embrace him. And luckily, I was in a position to take the image.
Mm-hmm. So there are so many photos of the war, both in theater during the war and here back at home during the war. As you considered the story that you wanted to tell, that you wanted to compliment Diana's reporting, her writing on, how did you decide to photograph this emotional trip back? You started doing that. I mean, was there a decision, or was it yours more reaction and seeing and then shooting the images you saw?
Well, it was reaction, but it was also, I had time to think about it because George and I had talked about going back, and I knew what he wanted to do once he got to Way City. You know, he wanted to cross the bridge. He wanted to see the university that is now a 5-star hotel. He wanted to go into the Citadel that I don't think he was able to get into in 1960-69. Mm-hmm. So when he crossed the bridge, I knew that I needed to be in a position to make those images.
I wanted to ask you one more question about the photos. We see a museum featuring the wreckage of a downed U.S. fighter. Seems to be sort of standing upright on its nose, this wreckage. It's at a museum. Also, you have veterans sort of searching and pointing out, oh, that used to be. I can just sort of see them. I can hear them saying, oh, wasn't that there? And then there's some of the Vietnamese people. You have a young couple getting married or about to get married. And then you have this 80-year-old woman in a village in the mountains with a pipe hanger. Tell us about those photos.
Well, it's, you know, we started out in Da Nang and we ended up in Hanoi. And in between those two areas, we made stops in Phu Bai. We made stops in
Khe San.
Mm-hmm.
We made stops in the mountain village near the Laos border.
That's where the 80-year-old woman was.
And that's where the 80-year-old lady was. And all of these images were images that I came across.
Okay. Some war veterans don't like to talk about their experiences, even with loved ones, or maybe prefer to reflect privately. Others maybe didn't have anyone they could share with when they got home. I'm thinking of Danny here. What did they say to you, Diana?
Well, what they've been telling me in interviews, not just when we were in Vietnam, but before then and since, is that it's hard to talk about this stuff with somebody who doesn't know, who can't relate. So a wife is waiting to listen, but he doesn't want to tell her about this horrible stuff.
He doesn't want to burden her?
He doesn't want her to think badly of him because maybe he killed somebody. Mm-hmm. You know, he can tell that to his buddies because his buddies would understand. So I think that there was always this barrier between the civilian, however close you are to them, and the person that you know, brother in arms.
Right. So did any spouses accompany the veterans?
There were six wives and two daughters and a son-in-law. So there was some family members.
How important was it, do you think, for them to maybe get a little more insight into what their family member experienced?
I think for some of the wives, it was important to see there's a portion of their husbands that they may not know, and this might have opened a door for them. At least that's what several of the wives told me. They were kind of hoping to maybe get a little closer by being a witness, like we were witnesses. Mm-hmm.
For both of you, your descriptions of Vietnam are that of a bustling, bright, youthful country. Did you get any sense of closure, maybe from the Vietnamese, as opposed to the veterans you traveled with? Nate, let's start with you.
I think George said he doesn't really know if he got closure. I mean, he's happy that he went, but, you know, closure, as he described it, is debatable. So, but I think it brought him closer to closure if it wasn't complete closure.
Yeah, I mean, it's interesting to me to actually think about this in terms of symbolic terms of footsteps, because each footstep these guys took, they were getting closer to where somebody was killed. And so it's kind of like, it's a very subtle thing, one step. And so maybe he took a few steps toward relief. You know, I mean, I'd love it if he could call in because he wanted to. But it's a huge, huge burden to carry. I mean, if you read about some of the just horribleness of these wars, it's hard for most of us civilians to even imagine dealing with any of that.
One final quick question, if I might. What's going to stick with you as journalists experiencing the emotion of these veterans? Diana?
What sticks with me is how badly we received the Vietnam War veteran home. One of my points was to elevate them above that war. And so these guys mean a lot to me. And what will stick with me, besides all of the images that we had of Vietnam and all of the amazing stuff it is to be a traveler in Asia, is just my feelings for these veterans.
Nate, final thoughts?
I echo those sentiments. I mean, it's just the newfound respect that I have for all veterans, not just Vietnam veterans. And it was truly a wonderful experience to be part of their journey back.
Pittsburgh Post-Gazette reporter Diana Nelson-Jones and photographer Nate Guidry, thanks so much for being here, and thanks for your great work.
Thank you so much.
Thank you very much.
And finally, at about 11:30 Tuesday night, the superintendent of Pittsburgh Public Schools and the president of the Pittsburgh Federation of Teachers announced they had reached a tentative agreement on a 3-year contract after a marathon bargaining session. That tentative agreement averted a strike that was set for today, Friday. The two sides had negotiated off and on for more than a year and a half. If the union board okays the deal, it will then go to the rank-and-file teachers, so Pittsburgh Public Schools will not experience their first strike in 43 years. That is, unless the teachers reject the contract agreement. And for this week, that is the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. The engineer for the program is Tom Hurley. Research and production assistance comes from Zakiya Majin. The producer of the confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good week of good news.